The primary purpose of each AA group is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. To pursue this work, Valley Group field agents search states for the finest recovery speakers to come and share their message of experience, strength, and hope with us. Each week, a single speaker is chosen from the many for their service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. What are you laughing about? You know them better than I do. Their first service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and now, Valley Group World Headquarters is proud to announce the winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week. The nominee for this category has a sobriety of 2/27/1972. He has been in continual service to the Fellowship as a treasurer, chairman, H&I representative, intergroup representative, literature representative, and sponsor. His AA motto is KISS, that is, keep it simple, stupid. May I have the envelope, please? The winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week is Paul M. from Fresno.
Thank you. I'm Paul, and I'm an alcoholic. Okay, stupid. I'm very grateful to be here today. I'm very grateful to be anywhere today. I did not get sober the first time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came here to these rooms and February 1971, at the insistence of my wife, she thought I had a problem. And I really don't know how she came to that conclusion, but I had a history of disappearing. And primarily, I thought I was just having fun. But before I get to that, I will tell you that I really don't remember the very first drink I ever took. It wasn't, you know, mind-blowing. My family drank. I come from a long line of alcoholics. My father, didn't know who my mother was until my father died. But I had a half-brother who was a real flaming alcoholic. And my other brother, who was 3.5 years older than I was, that was my mentor, he had a problem with gaining weight growing up in high school, and the doctor prescribed him a beer every day because they thought it would help him gain weight. He was tall and thin, and I was tall and thin. I was hoping I'd get the same prescription, but I never did. You know, we grew up. I remember my father was a hard worker. We farmed. I grew up in a little town called Patterson, California. And that's up north from here, right off of I-5 now. And I can remember my father coming in from work every day and having a couple, what they called in those days, highballs. You know, 7-7s, relaxed, took a shower. We had dinner, and he had a couple more, and he went to bed. So he'd get up at 5 o'clock the next morning and go to work. And that was kind of the, you know, image that I had of my life. I can remember age 11, 12 years of age during the summers getting up and going out and working in the fields, picking apricots, you know, hoeing weeds. And I remember the first time I got drunk, I was about 12 years old. My brother and I were out picking apricots and we stole one of the labor contractor's wine and I got drunk, got sick, and my brother had to take me home, and my parents asked him, you know, what happened? And he said, he ate too many apricots, Dad, you know. And I guess it was about another year after that I decided I was going to try and make my own homemade wine. We had grapes in the vineyards out in the area there, and like any good alcoholic, I couldn't wait for it to ferment. I kept going back and tasting it until it was all gone, you know. It never did turn into wine. It was still grape juice, you know. But I remember going out. My brother, as I said, was 3.5 years older than myself, and he had to cart me along a lot of times when he was out with his friends. And he liked to drink, and so primarily I got exposed to drinking through that. And we had chug-a-lug parties, you know, where you could see who could drink the beer the fastest. Those type of things we thought was fun, you know. Normal people don't do those things, I don't think. I've never heard of normal people having chug-a-lug parties, you know, and seeing how fast they could drink beer. But I wanted to also say, while that young lady was reading more about alcoholism in chapter 3, I identified with just about every one of those attempts to control drinking, except checking myself into a mental institution or asylum. And one of the reasons for that, I was afraid if I checked myself in, they'd never let me out. Because I did some pretty crazy things when I was drinking. I'm a blackout drinker. As I got older, my drinking progressed to the point where whenever I drank, I didn't remember coming home in the morning. A lot of times I couldn't find my car. I don't know if anyone's ever done that, you know. Come home and looked up the next morning and your car's not in the driveway or not in the garage or carport. You have to go find it. And a couple times I had some real difficulty finding my car, so I just called the police and turned in stolen, you know. And they found it for me. You know, you have to be pretty ingenious when you're drunk, you know. You lose a lot of things. You know, they say alcohol is a great eraser, you know. It takes away your job, takes away your marriage, takes away everything that you value. And, you know, I was telling them before the meeting that my motto is keep it simple, stupid. I read a lot of inspirational books growing up, Think and Grow Rich, because I wanted to be a millionaire by the time I was 25. Didn't happen. Power positive thinking, you know, because I thought if I really pushed myself to the limit, I could control this problem I had with people getting in the way of my drinking. Because they always seemed to do that, you know. I was always out to have fun, and somebody always got in the way of and interrupted the things that I was trying to do that I thought were fun. And the cops just don't understand, you know. You have a wreck, they want to check your breath, you know. Back when I was drinking, they didn't take you to jail in my hometown. They drove you home. That's the nice thing about it. But they were kind of, you know, towing me, enabling. We were probably pretty well known in the area I grew up, well-known family, and wrecked a number of cars. Some of them were parked that I did, and I kept telling the cops that somebody pushed them out in the middle of the street, but they didn't do that, you know. Hit a couple trees that I thought were in the middle of the road, but they weren't there either, you know. Done a lot of things I'm not proud of. You know, when I got here, I was bankrupt financially, emotionally, spiritually. And, you know, when I started taking a look at myself, I didn't like me too much. But when I get back to February of 1971, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked around the room, and I was there comparing, not identifying. And I looked around, and you people were old. You didn't look good, because I came in a business suit and tie. You know, I was a marketing rep at that time, salesperson, and image was important. And you people just didn't fit into my image of what I thought you should be, you know? And So I told my wife at that time that I could quit drinking on my own, and I proved to her that I wasn't an alcoholic. And based on my past behavior, that was a very large statement. So I went probably about 90 days without drinking. And I made a decision to stop and have a drink. And the next thing I know, Friday became Sunday somehow. I don't know if anyone's ever done that. You lose a couple days, you know, and came back home and told my wife, I don't know what happened. I don't know where I was at. I don't know who I was with. I don't know how much money I spent. You know, I cashed a couple checks. And I promised her. I said, you know what, it'll never happen again. Went to the minister and talked to him and prayed about it. Got in some counseling with the church. And about 60 days later, I got drunk again. It seemed like every time I made a decision to have a drink, I was off and gone. And I don't know if any of you have ever done that. And I was thinking, just going to have one, maybe two, no more. And I don't remember what happened. I was gone only one day that time. Came back, made another solemn oath, you know, that I was going to quit drinking. I remember my last drunk that year. I had gone about 120 days without drinking. And I stopped at a friend of mine's house to have lunch with him. I was mad. I had an appointment with someone. I was selling insurance at the time. And they had the audacity not to show up to the appointment. They weren't home when I got there. Well, I'll give them another chance. I'll go by Gary's house and I'll have lunch and then I'll come back by there. They're probably tied up. I'll meet them about 1:30. Well, I went over to Gary's house, fixed myself a sandwich, and I asked him, I said, Gary, what do you got to drink? He said, well, I got a bottle of wine in the fridge, but that's about it. And I didn't think to ask him for water, you know. I opened up his fridge and guess what he had in there? Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. Oh, you know what that is, huh? I don't know if they still make that stuff today, but I poured myself a glass of that, had the sandwich, and poured myself another glass. Gary had to go back to work, so I said, okay, I'll see you. And I drove back over to where my appointment was at, and they weren't home. I still weren't there, and I thought, has really torched me, you know. And guess what I did? I went to the nearest bar that I was familiar with in my hometown of Patterson. Went in and had a couple drinks. I got the bright idea that I'd go visit my elder brother who was working for the phone company. He was a foreman for the construction, the line crew. So I bought a six-pack of beer. I got in my 1969 Riviera, drove over to where he was working, talked him into getting in the car with me. We drove around the country, and well, his crew did the work, and we started drinking a few beers. I dropped him off at 5 o'clock so he could go log out. Told him I was going home. At that time, I was living in Modesto, California with my wife. And the last thing I remember is him telling me, drive careful going home. Well, I woke up Sunday morning in Reno, Nevada, parked outside that sign that says the biggest little city in the world. In those days, there wasn't a casino there like there is today. It was a parking lot. And I woke up in the back seat of my Riviera, my clothes all rumpled, my hair all messed up. And I thought to myself, my God, who drove me here? And I got up, combed my hair a little bit, kind of straightened myself up, and I started walking over the streets of Reno, Nevada, trying to see if there was anyone there that might have driven me to Reno. Guess what? Wasn't a familiar face there. Went back, got in my car, started it up, said, I'm going home. And I looked in my litter box, and I had a Chevron gas receipt for gas I had purchased Friday night in Sacramento. Don't remember driving. Don't remember getting up there. And guess what? My checkbook was empty. I had written $3,000 worth of checks gambling up there. Fortunately enough, I still had a little over a half a tank of gas, so I figured I could probably make it to Sacramento, buy some more gas at the Chevron station, and go on home. But I stopped and made a phone call to my wife. And you know what I told her? I'm done. I don't care if I have to go to that damn AA, but I'm done. And from that day to this, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol. That's been 15,052 days. And that's a Guinness's record for me. I'll guarantee you. Because I never believed that I was going to be able to stop drinking for any period of time. My history had proven that. Because I'd gone to church, prayed to God, got involved in counseling, prayer groups, the whole nine yards. And none of that was able to keep me sober because I kept forgetting one thing. Keep it simple, stupid. The first drink's the one that gets you drunk. And that's why I always say, keep it simple, stupid. I've never found anyone in this fellowship that has been too stupid to stay sober. I found a lot that's too smart for the program. They outthink what they need to do. And I have a committee that goes on up here. You know, it tells me a lot of different things to do. But the nice thing about it today is, you know who's in charge? God. I turned it over. You know, I said, I'm no longer in charge. You know, all these things can tell me all these things to do, and then I go to God and say, okay, what do you want me to do? And you know what? It's worked. My sponsor told me when I got here that this was the last stop for you before the morgue. And today I really believe that. I've seen so many people that go back out there and don't make it back. I think they have one more attempt to control and enjoy their drinking, and it doesn't happen. You know, I went through a lot of years of having fun and enjoying myself. I called it sowing my wild oats, and it was at other people's expense to a large extent. And I'm not proud of the fact that I've stole. You know, I'm a thief. I was a liar and I was a cheat. I had no morals about me whatsoever. Today, my life is completely different. Today, I feel like I am 100% honest. You know, when Sue asks me how does this look on me, I tell her it looks good. I'm not going to tell her I don't know, you know. But I also will tell her that, you know, I think that doesn't go with the way you look. That's as best as I can get it without really getting in trouble, you know. I don't steal from anyone today. I'm retired. I've been retired for a little over 8 years now. And I still don't cheat IRS. I never felt like I used to, but I certainly didn't give them the benefit of the doubt, I'll tell you that. I was reading, and I don't know if any of you saw that on TV the other day, where the government says they're going to get the FBI to investigate the IRS for these discretions they had against some of these key groups. You know, that's like asking the wolf to watch Chicken House. You know, they're going to get the FBI to investigate the IRS. You know. God, I wish that I had them on my side when I was drinking, you know. But anyhow, I like to think that I have morals today. I don't do things that I disapprove of most of the time. When I got sober, my sponsor also told me to get involved and become somewhat in service. And he was a big advocate of H&I, hospitals and institutions. So I got involved in H&I. Went to a lot of prisons. Went on. In those days, we had what we called 12-step calls. We had an answering service locally. You picked up the phone, you volunteered to answer the phone. If someone was drinking and needing help, you went out to their home and helped them get sober. I did a lot of that. And we had in my town of Modesto, we had an outpatient program that we used to take people to for counseling. And I got involved in doing that, and I did that for about 2 years. And they were in the process of organizing and starting an inpatient program. And as a result of my involvement with that outpatient facility, they asked me, after 2.5 years of sobriety, to become a counselor in that program. And I didn't know what to do. Because it talks about in our traditions becoming a paid service member, you know, getting paid for carrying the message. Did a lot of praying about it, did a lot of talking to my sponsor, and he told me, he said, God's opening a door for you. So I went to work for that facility and wound up counseling alcoholics for 13 years as part of my recovery. As a result of that, I got into marketing alcohol treatment programs and care facilities, and then got into marketing hospitals and got into medical marketing, and that's what I did until the day I retired. Service work is important. I was supposed to go tomorrow night to Pleasant Valley facility out in Coalinga. And as you well know, they've had an outbreak of Valley Fever there, so they've shut the facility down. We can't go in there. But I want to tell you, every time I've gone in there, there's a room full of about 50 inmates in each block. There's 5 cell blocks there with about 350, 400 people in them. And each time I've gone there, there's been about 50 attend a meeting in each one of those blocks. So you figure there's about 250 people attending AA meetings there whenever H&I goes in. So that's important. It's important we carry the message, regardless of how good or bad it is. And I'm going to tell you, I've never been to a bad AA meeting because I've stayed sober through every one of them. At least that's what they told me to say. I had a very important lesson happen to me with my first two sponsors. Both of them went out. And it really made an impression on me. What do I have to do to stay sober if they can't? And the thing that is after talking to them, I found out that they were not convinced to their innermost selves that they were alcoholic. And I got news for you. I am convinced to my innermost self. I don't care what happens. I've gone through divorces. I've gone through death of the family. I've gone through a lot of tragedy. Drinking has never entered into, you know, the solution. The solution has always been, what do I have to do to take care of this problem? And that's what I stay in today, is the solution. AA fixes everything if you allow it. And through my counseling, I had the opportunity to meet a very famous person, and I know a lot of you, how many here have gone through a treatment facility? Any of you see the movie Chalk Talk with Father Martin? I had the opportunity to meet him, spend some time with him. And you know what he told me about my defects of character? That they would die about 30 minutes after I do. And that's the honest to God truth. You know, it talks about making amends and getting rid of our defects of character. We never get rid of them. They are there. It's just how we choose to deal with them today and how we allow God to help us deal with them. I could still be a cheat. I could still be a liar. I could still be a thief. Those are all options. But I don't want to be that way today, and I know if I stay sober, I don't have to be. I will tell you that I went into the Army in 1965. They had that Vietnam War going on, and I didn't want to go. You know, I had a friend of ours at the Pentagon, and our family called him up and said, his name was John Azevedo, and I called him Colonel John. I said, Colonel John, I said, I'm going to get drafted here in a few months. And I said, I don't want to go in the Army and go to Vietnam. And I don't want to go to Canada. What's my alternatives? He said, well, Paul, I'm going to tell you. Go join the Army. I said, John, you're not listening to me. You know? Join the Army. If I join the Army, they're going to send me to Vietnam. He says, no, you join the Army. Tell them you want a European tour. Okay, so I did that. Joined the Army. Went down and saw the recruiter. Told him what I wanted to do. I wanted to join the Army. He got all excited. And then I told him I wanted a European tour. He goes, okay. But they didn't stop. Did that and went to Europe. But guess what it did for my drinking? It really put it on solid ground. They have some of the best beer over there in Germany. Good wine in France and Italy. I toured around. I had photographs of places I had gone and don't recall going there. You know, because of my blackouts. And I guess it was June of 1966. I got a 30-day leave, and I called my family here in California and told them I was going to come home. Well, on my way to the airport, I was drinking and ran into some lady that was on a tour with her college friends, and I never made it to California. And she never made it on with the rest of the tour. We took off drinking, and we were gone for a few weeks, and her family sent two bodyguards to Germany to pick her up and take her back to Texas. I was corrupt, you know. That's all I can think about it. I stole a tank when I was in the service. I'd never driven one, and I wasn't in the tank corps, but I wanted to find out what it was like to drive one, and they don't go over too well when you don't know how to drive them. I thought it'd be like driving a tractor because I'd driven tractors growing up. They're a lot different. But I didn't know I drove it until the next morning when my friend told me, and I looked out and I saw this tank out in the middle of the road, and I said, hey, there's a tank out in the middle of the road. He said, yeah, that's where you left it. I did stuff like that, you know. Someone said tonight that they had a twin, and I used to tell everybody my twin did that. I didn't do that, you know. Today, I don't have to talk about my twin so much, you know. Still, once in a while, I'd like to, you know, when I embarrass myself. But my twin is dead. He died February 27th, 1972, and I didn't even know it. Because this program has allowed me to quit making excuses for my behavior. You know, I found out I have a conscience. I found out that I have beliefs in a value system. and it's all from working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was raised a Southern Baptist, went to church, baptized, and somehow I felt like I'd lost God along the way, and felt like God didn't care about me anymore because of the things that were happening to me. But what I found out is I let go of God, and God didn't let go of me. And as soon as I reached out, He was there. I no longer feel alone. Sue and I have two dogs. One's a Alpha chocolate lab, and the other one is a beautiful golden retriever. And the chocolate lab, I mean, he rules everything. And I go out and feed him every morning. And that's when I do my meditation with God. I'll feed those dogs, and I'll sit there and talk to them. And they kind of sit there and look at me like, okay, you know, I'm listening. And I never did that before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I always felt like I was alone, and now I don't feel like I'm alone. I've got all the people in the world to help me if I reach out. And the only thing I'm asking and saying to you, especially the newcomers, get involved, make yourself available, do some things to help yourself. Because it is an inside job. It's not something that we get automatically. It's just not going to be given to you. You've got to earn it. You're not going to get sober by osmosis. You're not going to get sober by accident. You're going to get sober because you work for it. And the work is applying yourself and taking and doing the steps for the sponsor. Get a sponsor. Get a sponsor that's worked the steps, that has a sponsor. My sponsor has 53 years of sobriety. He's the only person in Alcoholics Anonymous that I ever came close to getting into a fight with. And that was 40 years ago. And he wasn't my sponsor at that time. He was another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He had, at that time, 11 years, and I didn't believe him. You know, he was too crazy to have 11 years. And today he's still crazy. He's a nice guy, and I love him to death. But one thing I made a promise to myself when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, that all the crazy things that I was capable of doing when I was drinking, if I needed to do them to stay sober, I was going to do them. I haven't needed to do them, but I still do crazy things. I'm 69 years old. I got sober when I was 28. I drank for 16 years. And that time I wrecked 13 cars. Four of them were totals. Walked away from every one of them. I'm going to ride my Harley to Texas in June. I believe in enjoying life, and life doesn't end just because we quit drinking. You know, Sue and I do a lot of things. Her son is an assistant golf pro at a country club, and he's going to play in a golf tournament in Jamaica in November. We're going to Jamaica for a week to watch him play golf. Those are the beautiful things that happen as a result of being sober. I have two children. I have a son and a daughter, four grandchildren. My son and daughter have never seen me drink. They've seen me crazy, but they've never seen me drink. And I want to tell you, we can still get insane if we're sober. We do crazy things sometimes. They become less and less. I'm getting to the point physically where I can't do some of the things that I used to enjoy doing all the time. but I still enjoy having fun. Going out with people, I have a couple friends that are not members of the fellowship that kind of look to me as their substitute father. I have some sponsees that I guess I'm kind of a substitute dad to them. I keep telling them, I'm too old to be your sponsor. You need somebody younger who's more capable of identifying with you. And they said, no, we don't want to identify with them. We want to identify with you. So I don't know. It's a wonderful, wonderful program. You can become whatever and whomever you want to be. That's the nice thing about it. Every time something has happened in my life that I thought was going to become a catastrophe, something good has always came out of it. Whenever a door closed, a wider one opened. Something better happened in my life. And I want to tell you, I have a significant other today who I care about deeply, would do anything for. And I never felt that way about anyone before. That's the result of this program working in our lives, that we become capable of being responsible. I'm going to end with this about the drunk that is out walking along the river. He came upon the minister out there baptizing his congregation. Anyone heard that story? Maybe not, but anyhow, he's walking along the river drinking out of his brown bag, and he walks up to this minister. He says, what's going on? The minister says, well, I'm helping people find Jesus. You want to find Jesus? Well, sure. The minister grabs him and puts him down in the water and holds him down there for a couple seconds and pulls him up. And he says, did you find Jesus? And he says, no. He says, well, hold on. He pushes him down in the river again and holds him down a little longer, pulls him up. Did you find Jesus? Well, no. He pushes him down again and holds him down there longer, pulls him up. The guy's almost drowned, you know. He says, you find Jesus? And he says, are you sure this is where you lost him? Yeah.